Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review.
Hello, everyone. I greet you from the road, from the famous Peabody Hotel in Memphis, to be exact, for the Federal Bar Association's annual national conference. Nothing much to do with immigration specifically, but remember, we are federal lawyers, and the immigration law section is boasting about 10 people at this conference. Progress. Most importantly, though, I'm here because my wife, Kim Gregg, and of episodes 15 and 16 fame, was one of five attorneys nationwide to be awarded the FBA's Younger Federal Lawyer Award. Kim is a career judicial law clerk for a district court judge in the Southern District of California, and she works her butt off. I and everyone else, clearly, are very proud of her. Mercifully, there's only one full case this week, so before jumping into that, I'm going to talk briefly about a case and something else that may interest you. Enjoy this quick week.
This podcast is sponsored by Journey Business Plans. Journey is the leading business immigration plan writing company in the United States. 10 years. And they know immigration. Heck, they started as an E2 company themselves. Journey prides itself on its responsiveness and overall customer service, preparing business plans for E2, EB2 NIW, L1, EB5, and much more. If you don't yet know about Journey and don't want to listen to just me, ask your colleagues, or even better, try them out. Visit www.journey.com and use promo code REVJOURNEY30 for a 30% discount on your first business plan. That's REVJOURNEY30. Or click on the link in the show notes.
So, I did first want to talk briefly about United States v. Coasisis, published by the Third Circuit on September 22nd. It's a big old criminal decision that doesn't really have anything to do with immigration, except that towards the end of the decision, it engages in an in-depth discussion on how federal district courts, and particularly those in the Third Circuit, calculate loss in a criminal case. How federal courts calculate loss and therefore order restitution, for example, is very relevant if DHS ever alleges that your client's federal crime matches the definition of an aggravated felony at INA Section 101A43MI, because of course that statute requires a showing that the victim suffered a loss in excess of $10,000. If DHS relies on the loss or restitution ordered by a federal sentencing court to meet that standard, the over $10,000 amount, well, you might have an argument, because the federal loss rules are not so straightforward in criminal court. Under certain circumstances, for example, a federal sentencing court may, quote, look to the perpetrator's gain as a surrogate for the victim's loss, end quote. And then, of course, order restitution or some other punishment as a result of that victim loss finding. But there's no way that that would satisfy the immigration aggravated felony definition. Defendant gains are not the same as victim loss for INA Section 101A43MI. All of this is a helpful reminder just how complicated victim loss can get, and how an in-depth study of U.S. Sentencing Guidelines Section 2B1.1 is often warranted when dealing with the immigration consequences of a federal conviction. While we're in the weeds this week, I thought everyone might like to know that my partner, Ed Ramos, published an article in Law 360, link in the show notes. The article is on the Child Status Protection Act, or CSPA, mere mention of which sometimes sends me into a spiraling panic. But USCIS has now twice amended its interpretation of the CSPA over the last 6 months, and so writes Ed, quote, USCIS's policy changes expand the CSPA's protections, enabling many children who were previously deemed to have aged out of eligibility to qualify for green cards through the adjustment of status process, end quote. I mean, with a quote like that, how can you not read the article? I strongly recommend that you review it and see how maybe your formerly aged out client can now benefit. Or if only to better understand the murky but highly consequential world of the CSPA and derivative visa eligibility. Thanks for the article, Ed. And that is United States v. Cosisis and Ed's article. Maybe a bit on topic then, we have St. John v. Garland, published by the First Circuit on September 19th, 2023. This case is about convictions. Miss St. John is from Trinidad and Tobago and came to the United States as a child in the 1980s. She became a lawful permanent resident in 1990, but unfortunately did not naturalize, as so often occurs in these cases, and then she started to get into some trouble. And not good trouble. One of her convictions was, quote, mayhem in violation of Massachusetts General Laws, Chapter 265, Section 14, for breaking into a woman's home and assaulting her with hot cooking oil, end quote. Her conviction was affirmed on appeal, and her removal proceedings began in 2012 while she was in criminal custody. An immigration judge held that the conviction and, I suppose, Miss St. John's sentence matched the definition of an aggravated felony in violation of INA Section 101A43F, a crime of violence, meaning she lost her green card and is removable. I wonder if that was based on a finding that mayhem satisfies 18 U.S.C. Section 16B, the crime of violence definition that is now unconstitutional. Not at issue and not discussed here. Because Miss St. John didn't have an attorney and conceded that the conviction was an aggravated felony way back in 2013, where, by the way, 16B was constitutional. At the time, Miss St. John pro se instead argued that she had been wrongfully convicted. It's an intuitive argument, don't get me wrong, but it's one that has zero chance of succeeding in immigration court, which is why legal representation is so important. Universal representation for people who can't afford it, like Miss St. John, might be very helpful. So, a removal order was issued against Miss St. John, and years later she was released at the end of her criminal term and placed into immigration prison, by which point she could finally get an attorney, this is years later, and that attorney got to work getting her Massachusetts conviction vacated through a motion to vacate and for a new trial based on alleged ineffective assistance of counsel in her nearly now decade-old criminal prosecution. Miss St. John filed a motion to vacate based on ineffective assistance, and then asked the immigration judge to stay her physical removal, which the immigration judge did. But then the IJ ruled on the merits of her related motion to reopen based on this pending motion to vacate her criminal sentence and criminal conviction. And the IJ held that merely filing an ineffective assistance of counsel-based motion to vacate a conviction doesn't make a conviction non-final for immigration purposes. Yes, a criminal conviction must be final to serve as a basis to remove a lawful permanent resident. But no, reasoned the IJ, merely filing such a motion in Massachusetts doesn't make an otherwise final conviction non-final. the BIA affirmed. All before the Massachusetts Criminal Court actually ruled on Ms. St. John's motion. Indeed, although the Massachusetts trial court eventually denied the motion, the matter remains pending and is fully briefed on appeal in the Massachusetts appellate court system as of the time of this First Circuit decision. The question before the First Circuit now, then, was the BIA wrong to hold that the mere filing of a motion to vacate or some other post-final conviction motion in the criminal context has no real effect for immigration purposes? No, they were not wrong, said the First Circuit. Under the BIA's 2018 decision, matter of J.M. Acosta, quote, for immigration purposes, a conviction becomes final when the defendant exhausts or waives the right to direct appellate review, end quote. That's totally what happened to Ms. St. John's conviction way back when, as far back as 2013, it seems. But in moving to vacate her conviction collaterally, at least for the ineffective assistance of counsel or other serious reasons alleged here, Ms. St. John argued that the motion itself made her conviction, quote, no different than that of a non-citizen whose conviction is being appealed directly, thereby undermining their finality, end quote. Now, to me at first blush, it seems like a difficult argument, particularly given the long line of BIA precedent on the issue. But Ms. St. John's attorney is very smart. Ms. St. John argued that prior BIA decisions that would have foreclosed this argument, quote, were implicitly overruled by the BIA's dicta in matter of J.M. Acosta, end quote. In J.M. Acosta, the BIA said that, quote, appeals, including direct appeals and collateral attacks that do not relate to the underlying merits of the conviction, will not be given effect to eliminate the finality of the conviction, end quote. Fine. Ms. St. John argued, though, that her collateral attack that does relate to the merits of the conviction thereby does affect the finality of that conviction. By negative implication, J.M. Acosta seems to support Ms. St. John's argument that her conviction is no longer final. Smart argument. To the First Circuit, though, under Supreme Court precedent, quote, the force of any negative implication depends on context, end quote. And here the First Circuit reads matter of J.M. Acosta more generally, and not really making a hard and fast ruling on this. Post-conviction relief wasn't really analyzed so deeply in J.M. Acosta, reasoned the court. I wonder why the First Circuit relegated all of this discussion to a footnote, though. More directly, not in a footnote of the First Circuit's reasoning. While convictions certainly aren't final when they're on direct appeal, post-conviction relief is a different animal. A, quote, motion for post-conviction relief, on the other hand, attacks an already final conviction, one that remains final throughout the pendency of the challenge unless and until relief is granted and the conviction overturned. So too does it remain final for immigration purposes, end quote. Of course, if the motion for post-conviction relief succeeds, the non-citizen is in a much better position. But then the non-citizen will likely need to wrestle with matter of Thomas and Thompson to ensure that whatever happened post-conviction is recognized by Attorney General Barr. Ah, the tangled webs we weave. That Thomas and Thompson stuff was me. This decision really ends with that final quote I just read. And so the court ruled that the BIA properly affirmed denial of Ms. St. John's motion. So her final order of removal, premised on this final conviction, remains final and executable. And that is St. John v. Garland.
So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, Feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all. And follow the show on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review. Or send us a tweet at ImReview. That's I-M-M Review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.